Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Visit the Robert Frost House in Franconia, New Hampshire, and the place almost exudes frost, at least the way we like to think of frost today. Simple, wholesome, and quaint. There's no major multimedia displays here, no huge gift shops, no bright, cheery tour guides, just a small two-story home set beautifully high among the White Mountains. Next to the house is an equally unassuming barn, where you can sit down on a wooden bench to watch a short Robert Frost documentary on a small TV VCR system.
Just specimens is all New Hampshire has. One each of everything, as in a showcase, which naturally she doesn't care to sell. She had one president.
Frost bought this farm in 1915, shortly after a 2.5-year sojourn in England, where he had published the two books that launched his career, A Boy's Will and North of Boston. Frost was so powerfully drawn to northern New England that, for many readers, he practically became the place. We read it over and over today in his poetry, and you see it as you walk the grounds of his Franconia home. It's what they sell here at the Frost Place, instead of cookbooks or snow globes. They sell Frost, and the poet's image of New England that many of us who've read, recited, and retained him want to believe in. The Frost Place's director, Donald Sheehan.
For Frost, this is the image of farms that fail, and the people who don't. Frost admired the courage and strength of the people, and the persistence to endure afflictions. And that's what his poems reflect, and that's what he loved about these people, about this place. And because he lived at a time that was undergoing change, in which the small family farm was being obliterated by large economic forces, he knew what it meant to face adversity in a difficult climate. So in a time of transformation, when John Kennedy had Robert Frost read at the inauguration in 1961, Frost presented to America the image of New England that survives and remains perpetually true.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. But Storylines is more than just a show about books. Each week we'll address a particular New England author's work and look at the issues that each book raises as we search for insights about where we've been, where we are now, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines New England, Robert Frost's A Boy's Will and North of Boston, along with After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England, edited by Henry Lyman. We'll look at our region's poets, our poetry, and how both help us understand more about who we are, where we're going, and what we're trying to become.
As much as the South has been known for its fiction writers, New England is noted for its poets. In fact, it's been said that you can find more poets per square mile in New England than anywhere else in the world. Longfellow, Dickinson, E.A. Robinson, E.E. Cummings, and Emerson, just to name a few. But of all the poets who've called New England home, none is linked more closely with the region than Robert Frost. At a time when many of our new poets seem to struggle to find an audience, and when poetry itself is less prominent in American classrooms, Frost still hangs on. Many New Englanders can still cite verses or whole poems. Americans continue to regard the poetry of Robert Frost as quintessentially regional, a body of work that captures the true nature of New England, its landscape, its psychology, and its people.
We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more there where it is. We do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones on these pines, I tell him. He only says good fences make good neighbors.
Frost has been considered an inevitable touchstone for the New England poets who followed in his footsteps. Maxine Cuman, Robert Penn Warren, Elizabeth Bishop, Robert Lowell, all successful poets, all contributors to the proud New England literary tradition, yet all operating in the presence of an 800-pound gorilla by the name of Robert Frost. Editor Henry Lyman's collection, After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England, reveals the yardstick that Robert Frost has become in New England poetry circles by tracing the progress of poets who emerged in his considerable wake. Lyman's anthology presents 30 later poets from all six New England states, and their work clearly reveals a New England in flux, a multi-ethnic New England, a more urbanized New England, and at times a lighter, funnier New England. These poems simultaneously embrace Frost, refute him, and even on occasion poke a little fun at him.
After years of bickerings, Family One put up a spite fence against Family Two. Cheek by cheek, they couldn't stand it. The main village looked so peaceful. We drove through yearly. We didn't know. Now if you drive through, you see the split wood, thin and shrill. But who's who? Who made it, one side or the other? Bad neighbors make good fencers.
Today on Storylines New England, we look at Robert Frost's A Boy's Will and North of Boston, as well as Henry Lyman's After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England. We're interested in the ways our poets and their poems seek to define us as New Englanders. How do landscape, psychology, and the region's elusive character shape the sensibility of its people? And as our region changes, what changing messages do we hear from our newer poets? We want to hear from you, too. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Tell us, does Frost still speak to you today? Do you see him as part of the New England landscape and the New England character? And in an age of strip malls, cell phones, and a homogenized culture, does Frost still matter, or does he matter even more today? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us now are two distinguished poets whose careers have intimately acquainted them with both the substance and the shadow of Robert Frost. In the studio, we're joined by Wesley McNair, one of the 30 poets listed in Henry Lyman's anthology. He's also the author of Mapping the Heart, Reflections on Place and Poetry. His two latest collections are Fire and Talking in the Dark. Welcome, Wesley McNair.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
And from a studio in Boston, poet Robert Pinsky, who founded the Favorite Poem Project during his tenure as the United States 39th Poet Laureate. He's now a professor of English at Boston University, and he's editor of the recent collection, An Invitation to Poetry, a new Favorite Poem Project anthology. Hello, Robert Pinsky.
Hello.
I thought I would start with you today, Mr. Pinsky, and, you know, we really need to fill in a little background for our readers, so I'm going to ask you, who the heck was Robert Frost? Where was he from, and how did he become what he became?
He wasn't originally from rural New England. He was born in San Francisco. He came to New England when he was, I guess, 10 or 11 years old, and he has written that he found the Yankees cold and unpleasant. He didn't like them. His father, a difficult, brilliant man, died in San Francisco, and his mother came with the children to live with her father-in-law and mother-in-law. She didn't particularly like them either. The father-in-law was a manager of a mill in Lawrence, where Frost went to high school. So his experience of New England was partly the experience of a mill town, of cold people. And as often happens to us, his imagination was formed by visits to relatives, to an aunt and uncle who had a farm, and where the landscape and the rural life that marked his imagination and marks our imagination through him was not the main landscape that he was in as a child or that he started with. It was the dream landscape. It was the landscape of his dream life, which I think is true for many of us. The place you went on vacations or your grandparents' place or something is what forms the imagination.
And this landscape meant so much to him that he turned it into an entire body of work. Is that accurate to say?
He based a body of work on it, but the melancholy, the coldness, the decay, the parsimonious, pinched quality of New England was part of his vision of it, and it is in the poems.
We have a poem, actually, that for some people shows that dark quality that you're talking about, Robert Pinsky. This is Robert Frost himself reading an excerpt from the famous poem Death of the Hired Man.
When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg or be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that were what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done.
An excerpt of Death of the Hired Man, read by Robert Frost himself. And today on Storylines New England, we are talking about Frost and other New England poets. We're looking at New England poetry and how it shapes our feelings, our attitudes about ourselves as New Englanders. Join us 1-800-892-6477. I'm Laura Canoy, along with Kevin Gardner. Our guests are poets Robert Pinsky and Wesley McNair. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Mr. McNair, I want to bring you into this. What do you pull out of that excerpt that we just heard, Death of a Hired Man?
Well, it came from Robert Frost's first book, his second book, North of Boston. And what I hear in it is the way he's trying out dialogue and poetry. There are also dramatic monologues in that book, and I think Frost, through this book, was learning how to speak in poetry, was trying out a voice for himself. What I learned as a poet from Frost was how to speak American, which is different from speaking English, and I learned it from thinking about the way in which he studied the speech of his neighbors and imitated their vernacular in his work. As Robert has mentioned, he wasn't a New England by birth, and he had to get used to the place, and yet, as he put it one time, Yankier and Yankier as he went along. But by imitating the speech of his neighbors, he ended up with a kind of American English with a New England accent, which was very instructive to me as I was forming as a poet.
Was this a new thing? Was this something that hadn't been done before?
Well, Ernest Hemingway said American literature begins with one book, and that book is Huckleberry Finn. I'm not aware of this American voice in poetry much before Frost, so I think that's one of the important things he brought to it. He would stand up in front of an audience and have the poem by heart and say, "Let me say you a poem." He was so concerned about the way a poem was said. He said the ear was the reader and the writer, and so the auditory quality, and especially the quality of conversational speech, was very important to him.
Robert Pinsky, as a poet yourself, is it hard to get out from underneath the 800-pound gorilla of Frost?
I don't think that Frost is that kind of figure for most of the poets I know. Uh-huh. For me, he's a great, great writer. As Wesley says, he does amazing things with speech through, in the quotation we heard him read beautifully, the pentameter line. William Carlos Williams, who's much closer to Frost than the adherents of either would say, does something similar. And I think Frost learned a lot from Edwin Arlington Robinson, who Minerva missed the clink of iron clothing, is it? And in Eros Turnos, she fears him and will always ask what fated her to choose him. I think you also hear speech, and in fact, in that poet, New England speech, Frost is completely great. I think that for a lot of poets, he's someone who is known for his second best poems, and is known generally through a kind of a stereotype. And I think poems like, he read from a great poem just now, but poems like Directive, To Earthward, The Most of It, and Old Man's Winter Night are actually the poems that are in poets' minds more than the one about the two paths in the woods and some others that are kind of the ones people get in grade school or in high school.
You know, we have to talk about that poem, though, Mr. Pinsky, the road not taken, as you said, the two paths going into the woods. That is the poem, Wesley McNair, that people cite when they think of Robert Frost. I want to play Robert Frost now reading from that poem, and then I'd like your thoughts, Mr. McNair, on just why this is the poem for most Americans that says Robert Frost.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no strip had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Robert Frost reading The Road Not Taken. Again, Wesley McNair, his really most famous poem. Why is it?
Well, it's quintessential Frost in that he sets a little event in the New England landscape, and then he teases over it to bring out the metaphor. Here we have this older narrator who's looking back at the morning of his life, at his youth, and he comes upon these two diverging country roads, these two life choices. And he takes the road that seems to be less traveled. He's going to be a nonconformist. And yet there's this passage, which is often overlooked, that you just heard. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Suggesting that in the older narrator's view, as I read the poem anyway, the roads weren't that different after all. So when we get to the end of the poem, that famous line, and that has made all the difference, it's hard to know how to say it. Again, Frost would like this dilemma. Saying a poem in one way or the other can make it mean one thing or another. Does it mean self-congratulation? Is there a sort of wistful self-mockery in the ending? It's not clear. So the conclusion becomes inconclusive. And to get back to something that Robert said earlier on, it's one of those poems that if you don't read it carefully, you can type as being a poem of certainty. In fact, Frost was a poet of uncertainty in his best work, and here we have an inconclusive conclusion then, as we find in so many of his best poems.
As you pointed out, Wesley McNair, and as Robert Pinsky has also pointed out, there's a great deal more to Frost than the ordinary image that most casual readers associate with him. We're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Right now, we want to bring in a new voice. This is Rebecca Rule joining us here in the studio. Rebecca is a New Hampshire-based writer and a storyteller and humorist. Rebecca, it's very nice to have you here this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
We want to recall some previous conversations we've had with you, Rebecca, in which you have talked a great deal about the New England character, the kind of character that informs Frost's poetry, the kind of self-contradictory character that shows up not only in so many of his poems, but in so many of the towns and cities of New England as well. I have heard you use the phrase quirky tolerance when you have described folks who live in New England, particularly folks who live in rural New England. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
Well, I'll give you an example. This is a story that was told to me, said to be a true story. Of course, we always say they're true stories. I think it is. But the story is that the fella moved in down the road and lived there quite some time, maybe 4 or 5 years before the time came, and he was going by the neighbors and stopped in and said, you know, I'm sorry, I should have stopped long before this. You know, I've lived on your road for 4 or 5 years. And the neighbor said, don't worry, we weren't waiting for you. Which I think that's a quirky tolerance.
You know, Rebecca, there's a lot of characters that come out like that in Robert Frost's poetry. Mm-hmm. Do you, on a regular basis, still meet Robert Frost-esque characters in New England today, even with all the modernization and urbanization that's happening in this region?
They are there, and they are, we are. Well, they're at the historical societies. They're at the libraries. I do a program on Yankee humor that draws big crowds. In fact, the last time I was out at a town, they said, "My God, you drew more people out than the supper did." But people come because they want to tell stories. They want to tell their stories, and they want to hear their neighbors' stories. And they're telling wonderful stories. A little lady in recently said, she said, "Now I'm 98 years old, and I've got a story, and it might be a little off color." And I said, "Oh, well, you go ahead and tell it." And it was a little off color.
Rebecca, as an expert, I would say on the different shades of color in the New England character, can you generalize a little bit for us and give us any clue about what it is that sets, if this can be said, sets New England characters apart from characters from other regions of the country?
Well, I think in some, I mean, I think we're misunderstood in many ways. When people say that New Englanders are cool, or get a sense that we're a little bit intolerant, I think that's not true. I think it's a matter of interpretation. That, you know, when over in Deering, there was a group of four men working on the road, and somebody from away stopped by and looked over at them and said, "Do you know the way to Carter Hill Road?" And all four in unison said, "Yeah." And that's sort of humorous for them, and it's also a direct answering of a question, but it's not cold. And after 5 or 10 minutes, one of them broke down and told the fellow the way to Carter Hill Road. So there's that sense of, you know, ask a question if you want a direct answer, and we'll give it to you. But I think it's a matter of interpreting us more than anything else.
There's a kind of literalism to that response, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Rebecca Rule, thank you very much for coming in. It's always
welcome.
A pleasure to have you. Rebecca Rule, she is a New Hampshire writer and humorist and storyteller. She lives in Northwood, New Hampshire. This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, and today we are looking at New England poets and poetry and how they shape our sense of place, our sense of identity as New Englanders. We've been looking at the works of that all-time New England poet, Robert Frost, and in a few moments we'll look at contemporary poets included in editor Henry Lyman's book, After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England. Our guests today are two well-known New England poets. Wesley McNair is in the studio. He lives in Maine. Robert Pinsky joins us from Massachusetts. And we want you to join us too. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here on Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy along with Kevin Gardner. And let's go to the phones, to Middlebury, Vermont first, and to Ed. Hello, Ed, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Definitely an interesting program. And of particular personal interest to me, because during the 1970s, under the auspices of Frost's daughter, I had a chance to be poet in residence of a sort at the Frost Farm in Derry, New Hampshire. And I wanted to mention that place as one of the sources of Frost's imagery and his sense of the land and its people. He may have considered the farming life as a dream when he was a kid, but he became far more intimately acquainted with it when he was there with his cow and his horse and his failed attempt at chicken farming. In my own work, I found myself writing on themes similar to his, not because I was imitating Frost, but because the place cast a spell of its own. And I think if the people who visit there will find that it really does.
You know, we are going to explore that place in just a couple minutes, Ed. Our producer, Keith Shields, went up to the Frost home in Franconia and talked about that place and what it brought across. I wonder, Robert Pinsky, what do you make of what Ed says and how Frost's place affected so much his poetry?
There was a lot of baloney to Frost, as well as a great artist.
A lot of baloney, you said?
I think so. Uh-huh. I saw him speak in the last year of his life when I was at college, and I have a lot of poet friends had the same experience in those years just before he was going to die. You could see him performing as Robert Frost, and there's a kind of exaggerated folksiness. I wish I had shut up and not been so judgmental and just listened. But I have spoken to many poet friends of my generation who can remember that. And I don't blame him for the baloney. The man was a great artist who was not much regarded until middle age. He published his first book at the age of 40. When people like Amy Lowell wrote favorably about it, they did it in very condescending terms. Terms Amy Lowell says, oh, I know characters like that. This is a very accurate rendition of them. And the fact that he was really a Horatian and Catullan, very graceful, sexy poet, wasn't apparent in the things that people said about him. And I think to this day, there's a frost who is repeatedly revealed by somebody or other as challenging, difficult, as Wesley says, uncertain. And there's a frost that partly is of his own making, who is grandfatherly and regional.
Do you think, Mr. Pinsky, that Frost's traveling roadshow of folksy country wisdom, the waning of that as an image that's still before readers, still before Americans and New Englanders, has opened the door in a way for a deeper appreciation of the truly complex and difficult poetry he did write?
It's kind of fragmented because now academics now think of him as a terrible man because there have been unsympathetic biographies about mm-hmm. his marriage, and I don't think he was a terrible man. He was not recognized. He was sometimes flattering to people who would control things like reviews and letters. Oh, for shame, you know, who would not be? I mention all this to pay tribute to the complexity of the man. And I don't mention the baloney so much to detract from him mm-hmm. as to say that this second, as we're talking about him, there are these elements of what is apparent and what is on the surface. And as with all of us, there was a lot more going on in him than he sometimes chose to display.
Mm. Wesley Mick, very, very quickly, how do you feel about that, what Robert Pinsky says? There's a lot of baloney to Frost.
Well, I think of the fact that he did. I was just thinking of Randall Jarrell's characterization of Frost playing the only genuine Robert Frost in captivity in that roadshow that Kevin mentioned. Maybe I'll just let it go at that because we have to move on.
All right. Wesley McNair, thank you. And coming up after a break, more on poetry, psychology, landscape, and the New England identity. We're going to move on and look at the works included in After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England, edited by Henry Lyman. And we'll take your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. The phone number again, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. You're listening to Storylines New England.
New England is a project of the American Library Association funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a different New England author and their work as a way to try and better understand who we are as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today, we're learning more about the New England identity through our poets and through the pages of Robert Frost's A Boy's Will and North of Boston and After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England edited by Henry Lyman. Robert Frost's poetry defined New England's land, its people, and its psychology in ways that have stuck to us indelibly for almost a century, while Lyman's anthology has showed the progress of New England's poets and its poetry in succeeding generations. These poets reflect a new side of New England, more open, more diverse, perhaps even a bit startling to readers who've considered New England solely through the works of Robert Frost. Here's Boston resident Ruben Carrizosa reading the work of a new New England poet, Martin Espada.
Mi vida, Wings of Fright, Chelsea, Massachusetts, 1987. The refugees run across the desert borderlands, carved wings of fright into his forehead, growing more crooked with every eviction notice in this waterfront city to the north. He sat in the office for the poor, daughter borrowed at sleep on one shoulder, and spoke to the lawyer with a voice trained obedient in the darkness of church confessionals and police barracks, Guatemalan dusk. The lawyer nodded through papers, glancing up only when the girls awoke to spout white vomit on the floor and her father's shirt. Mi vida, my life, he said, then said again as he bundled her to the toilet. This was how the lawyer, who, like the fortune teller, had a bookshelf of prophecy but a cabinet of empty cures, found himself kneeling on the floor with a paper towel.
Although New England is blessed with a rich poetic heritage, many still consider Frost its quintessential poet. Frost lived many places in New England. He spent his earlier years in Lawrence, Massachusetts. His remains are interred on the family plot in Old Bennington, Vermont. And he spent many of his most successful years in several homes in New Hampshire. One such home is a place in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, in a town called Franconia. Frost bought a farm there in 1915, and although he only lived there a few years, today the house and barn are preserved as a literary remembrance of America's favorite poet. Storyline's producer Keith Shields visited the Frost home and talked to some of the people who stopped by that day about Frost and what he means to them.
You see, it has been New Hampshire, New Hampshire with me all the way.
I'm Donald Sheehan. I'm director of the Frost Place here in Franconia, New Hampshire. One of the strongest memories I have of Frost is that he came to my university when I was an undergraduate, and he read to an audience, a packed hall on a spring night. And the most amazing experience was none of us in the audience could read through him as a person standing before us, and yet everyone in the audience felt he was speaking directly and intimately to us. And that combination of being opaque and accessible is unique to Frost as a person and as a poet. We think we understand the poems, and we do, but then there's another layer, and then there's still another layer. You can't exhaust Frost's poems.
I'm Janet Mulvey from Frederick, Maryland. This is my husband, Sean Mulvey.
You know, this is sort of a pilgrimage, I think, that one who's interested in letters should make. I think it's a lot like Hemingway is with novels. The beauty lay in the simplicity. Simplicity is the art. He's not trying to overwhelm you with fancy bells and mirrors, as it were. He pretty much just states what he sees and observes and tries to paint a picture of the reality he sees.
I'm a teacher part-time, and whenever I teach English, especially the unit on poetry, Robert Frost is always one of the top poets that kids study.
A poem like The Road Not Taken, I often think about it as the prel concentrate, you know, of poetry, a distillation of so many facets of life and a conclusion that is left up to the reader.
My name is Major Jackson. I am the 2004 resident poet at the Frost Place, and I'm a professor of English at University of Vermont. I've been here 2.5 months now, and I'm surprised at how international the visitors are to this museum. I mean, they come from Germany, they come from Japan, they come from Newark, New Jersey, they come from Memphis, Tennessee. It's amazing to me. And it was an aspect of his work that I had not given much thought to. And I think that's a testament to the power of art, to the power of language to impact people's lives.
My name is Wayne Westridge, and it's my wife, Jolene. We're from Honolulu, Hawaii, currently stationed at Pearl Harbor Naval Station aboard USS La Jolla. My wife has absolutely loved Robert Frost's work ever since she was a little girl, and she grew up south of New Hampshire here in Connecticut. We're here on vacation because I just returned home from deployment. Our favorite poem is The Road Not Taken. I like the last verse. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
To me, it's not doing something just because everyone else is doing it. It's choosing your own path in life. Yeah, I think that poem is kind of ageless, where people are always going to have that kind of decisions to make and trying to find their own way in life.
The poem that I admire most is the poem Birches, and normally I begin my classes on the first day of the semester reciting that poem from memory, and it wows the students because it's a long poem. And what they don't realize is the trick behind poetry, particularly Frost poetry, is his attention to meter and to rhyme, which allows us to embed the words in their memory. But that is the work of the poet, is to embed either whole poems, lines, phrases into the memory of either their generation or their region or the world. And that's what Frost does for me. When I see birches bend from left to right across the lines of straighter, darker trees,
I like to think some boys have been swinging them.
But
swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice.
Today on Storylines New England, we're talking about Robert Frost's A Boy's Will and North of Boston, along with After Frost, an anthology of poetry from New England, edited by Henry Lyman. And we want to hear from you. How do our poets help us understand who we are and how we're changing? Which poet echoes your New England? And does poetry matter now as much as it did in the days of Robert Frost? Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking with a couple of very distinguished New England and American poets, Robert Pinsky and Wesley McNair. Robert Pinsky, we can't let you go without asking you a little bit about the wonderful project you undertook as Poet Laureate of the United States. And that, of course, is the Favorite Poem Project, in which you attempted to find out which poems were the most beloved of all poetry, wasn't it? Not just American poems. And I believe that Frost placed two of his poems in the top five.
I thought of the project when you were interviewing the people who visit the Frost House.
Yeah.
And there's a DVD in this new anthology where you can see people, you see a school teacher read Frost's great poem, Out, Out, great and terrifying poem. The project was not statistical. I don't know what the top five poems were, but certainly many, many people wrote about Frost. And her letter about Out Out and the things she has to say about Out Out are very moving to me. And this is the third anthology to come from the project, and in every one there's been a poem by Frost, and they're always very feeling, very beautiful letters about those poems.
We know we have to let you go, Robert Pinsky, but
I could stay. This has really been so interesting.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to have you. Just very quickly, did anything about the poetry project surprise you in terms of how people regard poetry in this country today?
Well, we have people from every state of the union, every age. We have a lawyer who carries an Elizabeth Bishop poem in his wallet. There's a glass blower who reads a Frank O'Hara. And it's the variety, too. The more passionate the attachment to the poem, the less it seems to matter whether you're a New Englander who loves a New England poet. We have a Plath poem read by a Jamaican man. The school teacher I'm telling you about has a Polish surname. the more passionate somebody's attachment to a work of art is, when I look at the letters that we got, the harder it is to predict it. So an African-American woman chooses a poem by Alexander Blok, the Russian poet. And certainly Frost is, as I say, it wasn't a statistical project, but of the 20,000 letters and emails that we got from people who took the time to write about a poem, many, many, many were about various works by Robert Frost.
So it's safe to say that Frost's work is not going to go the way of, say, Whitty or Snowbound.
Frost is our poet. By the way, we got several very beautiful letters about Whitty or Snowbound. Wonderful letter from a woman who can remember her father saying saying it in snowy mornings. And there are people still reading Snowbound.
Well, Robert Pinsky.
More reading Frost. Real Pinsky. Pleasure. I wish I could stay and talk with Wesley and listen to what you have to do.
So do we. There are so many questions we'd love to ask you, but thank you so much. It's been a great privilege to have you here.
Well, my pleasure.
Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, Wesley. So long.
This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy along with Kevin Gardner, and today we're looking at New England poets and how poets and poetry create a sense of place, a sense of New England identity. We want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here on Storylines New England. To Manchester, New Hampshire next, and Ellen. Go ahead, Ellen, you're on Storylines New England. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was interested in the comment that was made a few moments ago about verses or lines from poetry being embedded in memory, because that's an experience that I've had as a child who grew up in Massachusetts. We vacationed in the White Mountains, not too far from Franconia, and we had a family friend who was a poet part-time and a school teacher, and her works always, like 40 years later, continue to run miscellaneously almost through my mind as I'm driving along. Hill country roads go up and down from hill to hill and town to town with promises to keep. That's one of them. She described as mountains as being plains hung up to dry, and the old man of the mountain, she said, within a small tree-shadowed space I can look up and see a face, and goes on to describe how if she deserted that favored sphere, the noble features disappeared. It's funny that now they really have disappeared.
Ellen, what I'm getting from you, I think, is, Wesley, a way that poetry helps us feel connected to landscape. Is that what you're getting out of also from what Ellen says, and do you feel that way yourself?
I can hear that in what she's saying. I also hear the something about the loss of the verbal culture. That is just a short time ago, people... new poems by heart, and of course she does even now, but I'm talking about young people not doing this anymore. And so many of the poems that at least in our region, that people committed to memory did have to do with landscape. And so maybe you want me to read a poem of that kind. Yes?
Yes, please. One of your own poems, and we should say a contemporary poem. We're going to move a little bit beyond Frost now and read some from Henry Lyman's anthology of newer New England poets, and this is one of your poems, Wesley McNair.
Thank you. Robert Frost said famously, writing free verse is like playing tennis with a net down. He didn't have much use for it. But nonetheless, I press on, as others do, in this age of free verse in America. This poem is titled House in Spring. Where it stands in the wind, unpinning the plastic it has worn all winter, there is not one tree, and nobody sees the long remnants unfolding in the late light. Now it is tossing them across the windowless pair of shutters and the great swollen place in the clapboards. Now it is drawing them back from the stairless front door again and again, like an old burlesque queen alone in the potato fields of Mars Hill, Maine.
That old burlesque queen line is so absolutely appropriate, not just because of what it describes in terms of the house, Wesley McNair, but also because a number of actual old burlesque queens live in houses that look remarkably like that one.
Well, glad that you would speak of it so kindly, Kevin. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go with that comment, but I have to say that when I was making the poem, in any case, I was in northern Maine and wanted to write a poem about this this life of poverty that I saw in northern Maine, this agrarianism conducted by poor people who, in spite of their social condition, pressed on. So this ravaged house was a way of speaking about their endurance.
We've talked a lot this hour about how poetry pulls from New England's landscape. And joining us now from Vermont is Steve Melanson, a Vermont barn restorer and preservation contractor. He's got a background in architectural history and historic preservation. And Steve, welcome. Thanks for joining us on Storylines New England.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, you restore old barns, one of the things that you do. How much of the work that you do is putting barns together for decorative reasons that your customers want, and how many of your customers are going to use the barn for agricultural purposes, you know, put a roof over Bossy's head?
Well, I think it's mostly, these days, it's mostly people who have a collection of expensive automobiles to store, stuff to store all their many possessions in, and unfortunately, there aren't a lot of people I deal with who actually are involved with agriculture anymore.
Hi, Steve. It's Kevin Gardner.
Yeah. Hi, Kevin.
You told me once in a previous conversation something I've never been able to forget, and that is you talked to me about how much you love ruins, specifically the ruins of old barns, and how you would much prefer to see a barn fall apart and sag into the ground and gradually disappear over many years than be taken apart and moved off to California to become somebody's trophy. Why is it? Tell us a little bit about how ruins speak to you about the New England landscape.
Well, I read somewhere that Robert Frost said that a poem starts with a lump in the throat, an effort to find fulfillment. And I've walked into many barns in Vermont, New Hampshire, and some so derelict that there are trees growing out of them, some only recently abandoned in pretty decent shape, but nearly all of them are signs of a life that no longer exists in New England. You'll see invoices recording milk, meter, hay sales tacked to the wall, a pair of old coveralls or boots covered with dust and cobwebs hanging on a nail, or handwritten signs over stanchions naming half a dozen or so cows, Bossy, Missy, Rosie. And then, you know, in the hayloft, there'll be a record of wagon loads of hay that have been scratched into a beam or a post. It's a record. It's a living record of centuries of work for life. Families who endured brutal winters and scorching summers.
You know, Steve, you're sort of getting into something that I wanted to ask you anyway. Again, New England's modernizing, changing. We've got our share of strip malls. You know, people shouldn't get the impression that we're all full of Frost-esque barns and quaint houses. How much, though, Steve, of Robert Frost's New England do you see in modern New England today?
Certainly less and less. I've grown up in New England. I grew up in northern Vermont. I see a lot of it in the catalogs that I get in the mail.
Right. Selling that image again, right?
From L.L. Bean or wherever, you know, selling chore coats so you can sort of live the dream life of the New England, the hardworking New England farmer and stuff like that. I see less and less of it, especially in this part of New England. Maybe it's a little bit more common up north in northern New Hampshire or northern Vermont, but certainly around here, southern New Hampshire and southern Vermont, it's getting to be more and more covered up with malls, and there's not a whole lot left.
You know, Steve, our poet guest Wesley McNair wants to ask you something, Wesley.
Steve, you mentioned catalogs. I was thinking of the current Christmas catalog for L.L. Bean, which I saw just before coming down here. You may remember there's a horse-drawn sleigh, but in the sleigh is not Robert Frost, but a family. And guess what? They're all decked out with L.L. Bean, what they call outerwear. There's a snowfall. It's dark, but they're going right past the wood toward town, and they have gifts in their lap. Apparently, they have miles to go before they finish their shopping.
Yes, yes. I'm afraid it's been reduced to that for much of what we see these days.
Well, Steve Melanson, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Steve Melanson is a barn restorer in rural Vermont. Again, our number here in Storylines New England, 1-800-692-6477, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477 to Burlington, Vermont, and Peter is on the air. Go ahead, Peter, welcome.
Hi. I had a question or a query. And an observation. As I understand it, Robert Frost was originally from California, and he is the adopted son of Vermont. And I just kind of find it odd or curious that so many ties been made in between Frost and Vermont. It's kind of like how Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, is adopted by Connecticut. It really seems that his observations of Vermont are so astute because he was from someplace else.
What do you think about that, Wesley McNair? Thank you, Peter, for the observation.
Well, Edward Hopper once said that we best know a place as we're just leaving it or just coming into it. And it is certainly true that so many of the interpreters of New England in art as well as literature are from somewhere else. And we look at contemporary poets in New Hampshire, for instance. Maxine Kuhlman coming up from down country to New Hampshire. Donald Hall started out in Connecticut. Charles Simic was in California, New York City, and other places. This so-called international poet, poet of all places, it turns out has written about this place too. And sees it perhaps the more keenly in those dark little parables of his about New England and especially New Hampshire towns, the more keenly because he comes from somewhere else. So I think you're on to something.
Well, and Peter, I'm glad you called not only for your comment but also to let everyone know that next week on Storylines New England, we're going to be talking about Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. So thank you, Peter.
Wesley McNair, there's so much I want to ask you about the relationship between poetry and place. You, after all, have written an entire book about this subject. But just quickly first, I was trying to think before the show started, if there are any other poets who are so deeply identified with place, with a particular place, whether they're from that place or simply associated with it. And I couldn't think of anybody whose connection to a particular region of the country seems to be as strong in the public mind as Frost to New England. Are there others?
Well, I think of New England poets right away, of course. I mean, right here in New Hampshire, I mentioned a couple of them. Just a brief mention of Emily Dickinson here, who I think is the poet of New England and certainly wrote about place before Frost got to it. She is the one who first transformed New England geography into metaphor. And Frost, of course, learned from her. But Frost, I think, managed to socialize place. And north of Boston, he brought these Yankee types from farms and towns into literature. And he also gradually began to place himself in this place, allowing us to experience it through his experience. And I think thereby gave the model to people like Donald Hall, whom I mentioned, and Maxine Kuhlman, who both write about New Hampshire from their own places in it. And I think it become pretty well known for their place poetry, too.
You mentioned Donald Hall, and of course Donald Hall's wife, Jane Kenyon, was also a very well-known New England poet, and the late Jane Kenyon. In the time we have left, I'd love to play one of my favorite Jane Kenyon poems. It's called Potato.
In haste one evening while making dinner, I threw away a potato that was spoiled on one end. The rest would have been redeemable. In the yellow garbage pail, it became the consort of coffee grounds, banana skins, carrot peelings. I pitched it onto the compost, where steaming scraps and leaves return, like bodies over time, to earth. When I flipped the fetid layers with a hay fork to air the pile, the potato turned up unfailingly, as if to revile me, looking plumper, firmer, resurrected instead of disassembling. It seemed to grow until I might have made shepherd's pie for a whole hamlet. People who passed the day dropping trees, pumping gas, pinning hand-me-down clothes on the line.
And again, that's Jane Kenyon, read by Brenda Foley. The potato, the poem is called Potato. And Wesley McNair, the thing that I like about that poem is, to me, as a 20th century American woman, not much of a poetry person, I have to admit, I find Robert Frost sort of up there, off there, out there. But Jane Kenyon, talking about peeling potatoes in the kitchen, the compost pile, I've had moments like that moment in Potato where I go, I really should compost this, but I really don't feel like it. That's what's sure. nice about Jane Kenyon's poetry and some of the more contemporary poets.
That was her gift for certain, and I don't know that I would use Frost as her inspiration. She was, after all, a religious poet, and I think maybe there's some Emily Dickinson lying behind this this poem, because she's, of course, talking not only about the potato, but through words like resurrection and redeemable, and through the reference to the common flawed people at the end of her poem, we have a sense that the potato is speaking for them too, that they too perhaps seem tossed away, and yet they also have the opportunity to be transformed and redeemed. And so for me, the religious poetry of Emily Dickinson is the tradition that Kenyon relies upon and extends in that poem.
One last quick question for you, Wesley McNair. You mentioned inspiration. Who inspires you out of all the New England poets, as a rather weighty New England poet yourself?
Well, there are lots of them. And as a matter of fact, many of them are in this book. We have Frost, but we have people like Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell and Hayden Carruth. I've touched base with all of them, and certainly Robert Frost.
Well, Wesley McNair, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. It's been a pleasure.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website, storylines.ala.org, or visit your local public library. Many libraries in your area will have copies of the books, program schedules, tapes of our past shows, and even discussion guides.
Storylines New England is produced by Case Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan, Susie Darrow, and Rebecca Kaufman. Brenda Foley and Ruben Carrizosa performed our readings today.
Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries. The executive producer of the Storylines America project is Paul Zalis. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Join us next Sunday for Storylines New England.
New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, technology, politics, and Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Twain's cutting story about a Connecticut Yankee who travels back in time takes a satiric jab at the politics, thought, and exploding technology of late 19th century New England.
We'll look at Twain, as well as our region's contribution to American politics past, present, and future, on the next Storylines New England.